amazing people, you always want to work with them. If you see several of them, you know, go after a new space, you better do the same, right? Like we in the venture capital industry have that, I would say, Fortinet event where founders lead us there. He said something that still resonates today, which was, I want every single person who opens up the Snap app to smile and feel happy. It's like, wow, you know, that's pretty powerful. Normally, when it comes to like later stage companies, it's a lot more about the metrics and less so about the storytelling. So over there, you know, companies tend to be buttoned up because the expectation by growth investors is that, oh, I need to see your financials and this should be in extreme detail. I want to see a model for the future and to be pretty good.
Nico, it's good to see you. It's been it's a pleasure to have you here. You have been one of the most well-known investors for the last 13 years, as you mentioned earlier. So it's pretty excited to have you here. But let's start by your prehistory. What's a prequel before becoming an investor?
Sure. Kyriakou, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be on your podcast. Really excited for this conversation with you. So before joining General Catalyst, our firm, about 13 years ago, I was in the business of collecting a lot of academic degrees. So I was made in Greece, grew up between Greece and the UK, and for almost, you know, like 7.5 years, I was in college and I collected degrees in electrical and computer engineering, manufacturing engineering and management, did research in biomedical signal processing, and then ended up at Stanford in 2009 to study management science and engineering. And at that time, everyone and their mother was building mobile apps and was interested in building the next big social network. So it was a great time to replicate. Unfortunately, we're a few years, you know, too late. But during that process, met a lot of venture capitalists and ended up joining our firm, GC.
What brought you to Stanford? I think it's more of the rare moves for European founders. So what got you there?
Yeah, I was really inspired by a lot of the content that I was seeing, especially on eCorner at the time. They had a ton of notable today and back then somewhat notable founders tell their stories showing up at Stanford as part of the Entrepreneur Thought Leader Seminar Series that the Management Science and Engineering Department was running at the time. And I was really inspired by the content that I was consuming. It was like TED-like content, but for all things tech, entrepreneurship, and engineering. So I filed an application, was fortunate to get in, got the Fulbright scholarship that let me, you know, like have access to capital and do it. And that was it.
What would you say was different in Stanford? Did you find something different than the days in Cambridge?
I think Cambridge certainly was a lot more fun because the social life there was a ton more vibrant. And for some reason, at least at the time in 2000, you know, like, 2009, when I was there, folks were not as obsessed, you know, with like finding a job and lining up their next career opportunity. At Stanford, everybody was like, oh shit, you know, we're deep in student debt. We need to make it work. However, the connectivity that Stanford had with Silicon Valley was like incredible. Like you could walk around the campus and see, you know, Steve Jobs walk his dogs, you know, or you could go to the grocery store and see at the time, Mark Zuckerberg, Aaron Levy, like all those people who were like young millennials at the time, do their grocery shopping. And you could cold email all those people. Like a few of my classmates and I called Elon Musk and he applied and we saw him. So connectivity that Stanford had with Silicon Valley was incredible for those of us who were really eager to put it into use.
Can you tell why is the case? Because every time I come to Stanford too, it's near all the big investors as well. They are very close. And I'm always wondering, why is this not the case in Europe? Why would you not have the same near Cambridge, for example, or Oxford?
I don't know. And also Europe has changed, you know, like a few months. I can't speak to Europe, but what I can tell you about California, my theory is that it's because it's a newer place still. Like the whole area, you know, has a history of less than 150 years, you know, at least it's a civilized place. And as such, there is that feeling, you know, that we're all in this together. Failure is an option and it's okay to fail. Maybe you learn something, but let's help each other so we can all rise, you know, together and increase the size of the pie. In Europe, I found by virtue of, you know, mostly growing up here and now having done a little bit of business here over the years, is that things tend to be more formal. This is also the case in the Eastern, you know, part of the United States too. And that you need like to get a trusted introduction to go and meet somebody important, etc. So that's my theory, but I don't know for sure.
And then how did you hear about GC the first time?
I heard about GC through a Stanford classmate, friend of mine, who got an email from Chris Farmer, now the CEO of Signalfire, a really awesome venture capital firm, saying, found your profile online, you're really interesting, I'm looking for a VC associate, do you want to interview? And that friend of mine said, I'm not interested because I'm moving back to Europe, but I have a friend of mine who's interested in doing that. That friend was me. And that's how I got connected to GC. And I'm eternally grateful to Chris for giving me a chance, and of course GC, to join the industry, because I was not thinking about doing so at the time.
Hmm. And then GC at the time was it a very successful firm, would you say, or was it different than today?
GC at the time was 10 years old. We were only in Boston. And the idea was that we would expand in the West Coast with Hamant in Asia and one of the other partners at the time moving to San Francisco from Boston. And they recruited Chris, who recruited me, and a couple of other people from Boston, emerging investors moved, and that was the initial team. So we're a very well-known and successful firm in Boston, but we were unknown in California, and our best portfolio companies in California were known as other, you know, California-based firms, portfolio companies.
Hmm.
So I would describe DC at the time as a very well-funded, you know, startup that was opening up a new office in California, trying to compete with the legendary firms and their home turf.
So probably it's been a very long way since, because GC is considered one of the best funds in the world today. So what was the first thing that you did when you joined? Maybe it would be very interesting to hear your journey and how did this office grew, and now that you're in Europe as well and around the world. So what was the first role that you had there and how did this evolve?
Yes, sure. So when I joined, I was not a decision maker. I joined as an associate to help the team of six at the time in California get started on the ground, and then work very closely with Chris Farmer, who was the lead, and our partner, Hamant in Asia, who had just moved, you know, to California from Boston, to establish the nationwide seed program for the firm, which was a new activity, an initiative at the time. And in my first year at GC, basically I was a young person on the team who was spending all of my time pretty much on campus at Stanford, meeting everyone who said, I am a student founder, I'm interested in startups. This was job number one. Job number two was to go and meet with as many of the YC companies that were going through the program in 2011, 2012, and granted it was much easier because it was like a few tens of companies per batch, not like, you know, the several hundreds of companies per batch now. And thirdly, I was also, you know, paying attention to the app store, like the mobile app store, and anything interesting that I really liked, it was called emailing the founders. Mm-hmm. So my job was in essence to source compelling investment opportunities, mostly in companies led by young millennial founders.
Was that the period when you meet the Snapchat founders?
Yeah, I met them through a lot of the Stanford connections that I had a year later in 2012. So I met them when they were still when Evan was still a senior at Stanford. And this is the beginning of the journey with them.
And then can you recall when you met them, were you thinking that they would become the company they are today?
No, I was not. But I do very much remember the first meeting because Evan had a point of view of building the fastest camera app out there. He was the only founder had that till that time that did not want to build on top of Facebook. Everyone and their mother at the time who was doing stuff in social networking or consumer in general was building on top of the Facebook graph. And thirdly, he said something that still resonates today, which was, I want every single person who opens up the Snap app to smile and feel happy. It's like, wow, you know, that's a pretty powerful feeling that your product, you know, could evoke. Of course, you know, it was hard to imagine that Snap would own the selfie revolution in the years that followed. And it turned out to be a perfect storm because at the time, the iPhone for the first time had a high quality front-facing camera. And a lot of young girls at the time, teenage girls, were really eager to take selfies of their of themselves while they were going through their day and share it with their besties. And, you know, over time, this became one of the leading communication and entertainment platforms that we have. And recently they surpassed, what now, 11 years later since then, 750 million monthly active users. Pretty cool. Looking forward to when you do that, okay? With Terra.
Sure. When that was 1 year in into Jira Catalyst, and then how did when did you
this
become
was,
a decision
maker? This was a year and a half.
A year and a half. Okay. And when did you become a decision maker?
So I was given the ability to write checks as a principal in 2013, but then I made partner in 2015 and then became a managing director in early 2016. So it took me basically, you know, call it 5 years to climb through the ranks and become a partner at the firm and represent the firm on boards, etc.
And did your philosophy change over the years when it comes to where you invest?
Of course, because as much as I wish, you know, I could only invest in photo sharing, communication apps and stuff that I enjoy using, the market conditions, the founders pool, and the technology changes around us. So for example, if I were to quickly rethink, you know, my venture capital investing career over the last 13 years, I would say the first five were pretty much devoted on most we're devoted to first-time founders building mobile products, a lot of them consumer-facing. Why is that? Mobile apps had an easier time back then with distribution. And then very quickly, you know, in 2015, 16, became apparent to me and a lot of others that the era of easy growth had come to an end. So I made the transition to mostly become a future of work investor, investing in solopreneurs, SMBs, and individuals to help them with having access to more opportunity, make more money, upskill themselves, and live a more fulfilling life. And then the last year and a half now, I went back to predominantly investing young technical founders who are building products for themselves because a brand new generation of founders has come online, Gen Zers and Zennials, who are different than those before them. So I spent the bulk of my time investing in that extraordinary group of individuals.
Hmm. But Nico, this requires a lot of you need to all the times catch up with what's new. So how do you go about that?
It sounds hard, but at the same time, you know, if you're in conversation with so many awesome people that we have as founders in our portfolio, we have as executives and employees in our portfolio companies, I have so many talented partners and colleagues at GC. You know, I do network for a living. So the best and the brightest that we come across, if we see, you know, some of them being eager to do the same thing, you know, it's like 1 + 1 = 2. Like amazing people, you always want to work with them. If you see several of them, you know, go after a new space, you better do the same, right? Like win the venture capital industry, have that, I would say, ForgeNet event where founders lead us there. They lead us to the future.
So you would have a lot of smart folks around in GC and then get to meet a lot of smart folks around in the world. You mentioned that you are a professional networker. How does that work?
I said I am networking for a living. Like every day, I do meet 6 to 10, you know, founders and others in the ecosystem. Pretty much everyone I meet, I ask them, hey, who are some other founders or people that you regularly talk to compare notes, learn from, etc. So I write down these names, and some of those people I know, some others I don't. Or every time we're interested in investing, we do references, and through that, we meet others. So again, you know, if you get paid to take meetings and occasionally invest as we do, you meet a lot of us.
How can you
also
tell
at GC, we believe a lot in community and content. And in the themes that we're interested in, we're pretty active through these activities that are organized by our awesome, you know, like teams internally. We do engage with a lot of folks. Like, for example, this past month, I've been traveling all over Europe with our awesome team here on the ground in Europe and hosting office hours along the way. And I've gotten many hundreds of people from Amsterdam, Berlin, Paris, Tel Aviv, London, of course, where we have a great office, and soon in Athens, our hometown.
Are you going to have an office in Athens?
No.
No, okay.
We're not. Too small market.
Okay, okay. Right. When you meet someone, you mentioned that you meet folks by introductions, but then how can you tell? What are you searching for during those meetings, and how can you tell they're great founders?
First off, most times we get it wrong, right? But at the end of the day, every time I meet a founder, what I'm trying to answer is the following question. What if she or he is right? How big could it be? That's the question or set of questions I'm trying to answer. And certain people are amazing storytellers, are ridiculously ambitious, can lead, or stunning recruiters and serve as talent magnets, are technical and can build for themselves, or customer obsessed. So the more of these, you know, you demonstrate you have, the more likely we are to say yes.
Mm-hmm. Those are a lot of categories. Can you recall an example for someone that is listening now of, here's what I listened before and here's how why it worked?
Yes, like for example, when I met you, right? You are certainly not the domain expert in all things there are today, but you're an individual who were clearly ambitious, very curious, were eager, you know, to come and play in the big leagues. I remember you flew to San Francisco to meet me, meet some other people at the time, network. Like, who does that, you know, on their own dime, especially as a recent graduate? Few people do that. I think that already set you apart. Two, you're very curious to learn more about your customers. And you've been great all along, you know, asking people like me to make intros to potential customers, learn from them. I noticed that you are able to lead by virtue of recruiting other mostly technical individuals, which is an asset if you can do that. Like, you already had an awesome, you know, technical co-founder, Raul, and also for some reason you're able to get a lot of the Imperial recent graduates or soon to be recent graduates to do stuff for you on the cheap. Yeah. These are some of the things I saw, you know, back then when we first invested in you in late 2020. And of course, the last thing to mention, well, you had like insane perseverance, which I think is required for a very early stage founder. I think you were pinging me almost every week, you know, at the time to grab my attention or to have me do stuff for you.
Here's the cheat code then of how to do it. I have a few more questions here. I see that you invest a lot in consumer. Most investors that I hear about are not investing in consumer primarily because of the non-B2B nature of it, and it's more difficult to grow there. Why are you investing mostly in... Why do you invest in consumer, and why are you excited about that?
Yeah, so I do invest in consumer. I've been investing for a long time. We at GC are very excited about all things consumer investing, in particular right now. Why is that? After a very long time, we have a brand new pool of founders, the Gen Zers, and some of the young millennials or Zennials, who all live in their heads in the future. They're different than those before them because they grew up in a different setup. And they have bright ideas of how the future phase of the internet should look like. The current phase of the internet was put together largely by geriatric millennials like myself, all the people who created the likes of Instagram, Tinder, Facebook, Discord, Snap, like Cluster being GC portfolio companies, WhatsApp and others, were folks, you know, who are in their mid to late 30s or early 40s now. Here's somebody who's like, you know, 18 to 22 after like 10 to 20 years of having used these products. Now, they're like, I think I can do it better. So that's one reason, you know, new founder pool coming online. Two, actually distribution at the moment seems to be easier or cheaper if you know how to speak TikTok, if you know how to speak Discord. And when you have access to free or cheap distribution as a consumer founder, it's the beginning of the good times because you can get a few hundred thousand, if not a few million users to check out your product. That's the hardest thing. As a consumer founder, the hardest thing is to get consumers to give a damn about your product. So if now you know how to speak Discord or TikTok, it's a very big deal. Thirdly, most people indeed, you know, don't care about consumer right now. They don't invest in it. So sure, you know, fundraising will be a little bit harder, but at the same time, it means that you won't have like five copycats go after you 6 months after you launch. So you have more time to figure things out. So these are some of the reasons I think, you know, why now we're seeing an early renaissance for all things consumer building with fresh ideas by fresh, you know, new, mostly young people and limited competition. So in a few years, we'll become a lot more obvious and we'll have some sizable early successes.
And also, Nico, you are a very early stage investor as well. It ranges from pre-seed to Series A and so on. Why that early?
Yeah, so we at GC, earnings are core. So the firm is 23 years old. For the first 10 years, we're only doing early stage investing. Now, of course, we're a multi-stage venture capital firm that writes checks that range from $250,000 to $250 million. By deal count, we are a seed investment firm. So we invest about 40 pre-seed and seed rounds a year that we lead in the US, Europe, and India. We invest in about 15 Series A and early B rounds a year that we lead or co-lead. And then we do, you know, 8 to 10 growth rounds a year that we lead or co-lead. So the early side of the house is what drives all the other awesome, you know, funds that we have.
What are the mistakes that you see from founders when they're trying to raise funds in the early stages?
I don't know where to start, but let me say a few of the common, you know, pitfalls. One is a lot of founders that don't take fundraising seriously, and they think automatically, you know, it would happen for them. So doing it one meeting at a time, or not knowing your audience, or not, like, you know, being prepared for it, it shows. And if you think about it, all of us investors, in essence, are professionals at saying no very politely. So knowing your audience, taking this activity seriously, doing it with a serious commitment over a few weeks, and asking, you know, like some founder friends of yours to really help you out, could make a hell of a difference. Two, you could see founders who show up at a meeting and the body language with their co-founders won't be great, or it could be that they disagree, you know, in front of the investors, like stuff like that, you know, sounds crazy, but it happens, you know, pretty often.
Like what can you recall something?
Yeah, yeah. You could see, you know, like I could ask you something like, hey, tell me a little bit about your technology stack. And you may tell me one thing, and then your co-founder will be like, hey, actually, you know, we migrated to something else. And I'd be, you know, that's clearly, you know, a red flag. Or I would ask you, what do you have on your product roadmap? And you tell me, and then your co-founder would say, yeah, this is something we'd launch, you know, like a week ago. You'd be like, huh, this person's clearly not a product, you know, founder as he makes it sound, you know, about himself. Thirdly, knowing your metrics. Not necessarily the case, you know, for pre-seed or sometimes, you know, seed founders, because there are no metrics, but for some seed and, of course, you know, Series A or later stage founders, asking questions about all things metrics and either, you know, hearing no answer at all, or then, you know, you hear an answer and you go and verify after the fact when something different, clearly you lose interest. And so, in a situation, if you don't remember a specific metric, to say, look, I don't have it on top of my head. Do you want me to email you afterwards, or can I take 30 seconds out to look? An answer like that is a perfect answer. But to give one that's not partially true, or be like, I have no idea, this doesn't show, you know, pretty well. Yeah, I mean, I can go down the list, but
yeah,
these are some of the more common, you know, pitfalls.
Yeah. Do these change in later rounds? For example, in a Series B, Series C round, would these mistakes change?
Some of them would stay the same, actually, you know? I think anything that has to do with people, it could stay the same. Normally, when it comes to like later stage companies, it's a lot more about the metrics and less so about the storytelling. So over there, you know, companies tend to be buttoned up because the expectation by growth investors is that, oh, I need to see your financials and this should be in extreme detail. I want to see a model for the future and it should be pretty good. Because if you don't have that staff and you don't have like a strong, you know, CFO and support you who's been through financings like that before, chances are you're not going to succeed. So like my advice to like founders who are raising growth rounds is to have an awesome, you know, support system internally led by a VP of finance or a CFO who's gone through a number of venture capital financings before. In the absence of that, oh my God, you know, you're going to die through going through all the diligence, you know, due diligence requests. And you won't have time to fundraise, or you certainly won't have time to run the business, you know, while you're fundraising.
When it comes to, we spoke about consumer, when it comes to healthcare, what are your views? What are the biggest problems that you see there? And what companies are you excited?
Yeah, so at GC, healthcare is one of the core areas we're investing in. We have our health assurance fund led by Holly Maloney and Chris Bischoff. And I would say about 30% of the capital we've raised were investing in healthcare at GC. So we do believe there is a ton of opportunity in the space. It is one where, for pretty much everything that we do other than biotech, it's not about like creating new markets, but it's about going after the existing ones with better product, better experience, and of course, you know, and fine-tune a good market approach. So one of the biggest challenges in healthcare is exactly that, because you're not trying to create a new market. You need to have incredible people on your team who understand who owns the budget, what is the billing code, how you can get access to them and get paid. So a lot of founders, especially the younger ones, if they don't appreciate that or at a minimum be curious about that, it's going to be really hard for them to make a dent. So you see the best healthcare teams from day one have individuals on the co-founder or at minimum the founding team roster who have the Rolodex and have successfully navigated the good market, you know, side of the house. In healthcare, as you know, it takes time to figure out that stuff if you are like a novice or first timer. And when you're a young startup, you can't really operate on, oh yeah, you know, we're going to have our first sale a year later, you know. That's not going to happen because you raise capital for like 18 months, maybe 24. So in essence, you know, if you're a really good company, you raise every year. So you need to demonstrate progress. So yeah, I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And especially in the Western world, in like every country has different, you know, rules and systems. So knowing how to navigate that is important. In the US, for example, people don't really pay out of pocket again and again for all things healthcare, unless they're very wealthy. But, you know, for the bulk of the people, the expectation is that their health insurance, you know, pays for stuff, or their employer pays for stuff. So unless you know how to tap into, you know, insurance carriers and employers for money for your service, like they are the real customers in essence, it's not going to fly. Mm-hmm. You may have some success early on, but then the end consumer will churn because they will get tired or they will be unable to afford how to pay for your product insurance.
I think Livongo was one of the big successes of GC by investing very early. Can you recall their story?
Yeah. So my partner, Hamantaneze, was the lead. I was fortunate to be a fly in the wall and be the young person on the deal team. Was supporting Haman, learned a lot through that process. And alongside Haman was on the board for a couple of years in the beginning. I would say some of the quick, you know, things that we got right at the time were the following. One, going after the chronic diseases space was a great idea, and especially going after diabetes, because there was a way to go after eliminating a ton of the healthcare spend that was taking place and still takes place in the U.S. Two, partnering with Glenn Toulmin and Lee Shapiro from day one was amazing, because those two individuals had been selling to self-insured employers and health insurance carriers for a couple of decades, you know, before really starting Livongo. So they knew exactly who they should be, you know, selling to. Three, being one of the very first companies to systematically and aggressively target self-insured employers, which turned out to be a new distribution channel at the time, was a great idea. For positioning the company as a Silicon Valley company with great product and tech team, building a superior product at a time and in a space where all the competition was very junky, made a hell of a difference. Of course, there was a lot of luck involved too, as is always required for all startups, even the very successful ones. But yeah, over a period of 6-7 years, they managed to get some really big customer accounts that moved the needle. They went public and COVID accelerated everything for all things telehealth. And they benefited enormously from that as well.
Awesome. Now, if I change a bit the scope, I ask you a again about this 2 weeks ago, and you told me I should ask you after 2 weeks. And so let's make it through this podcast. What are your thoughts in terms of hubs, ecosystems? I know you spend a lot of time in San Francisco and in New York, but you also travel a lot to the EU and Israel and so on. What are your thoughts about maybe the European ecosystem? Things you would like to see changed here? And then what are the main differences with the US?
Sure. So I spend the bulk of my time split between San Francisco and New York. I would say 80% of my time is spent, you know, in these two cities. And then the rest is in Los Angeles and various places in Europe. Most often a combo of London, where we have a terrific team on the ground led by Chris Bischoff, Tel Aviv, and Paris. I think the European tech startup ecosystem is at an all-time high when it comes to ambition by founders on the ground. And that's pretty, you know, like obvious if you go and meet with founders on the ground, in particular, you know, in Tel Aviv and London, that attract some of the best and the brightest who want to do startups. You also have fantastic, mostly consumer-facing and AI talent in Paris. And this gives them a shot to be in the forefront of creating some very compelling, you know, companies for the future. What Europe is lagging behind is having a ton of exits that will come, that will result in a lot of wealth get created so that a ton more mafias, you know, can be launched, and you have this very awesome virtuous cycle where early employees become very active angel investors. Some of them become notable second-time founders. You have a deeper talent pool of executives and mentors that you can tap into. And, you know, you start seeing this reinforcing loop that keeps going and results in the whole ecosystem getting bigger and bigger. In Europe, unfortunately, you don't have the large, you know, like easier to access common market that we have in the US. So that's a challenge. And of course, you know, this is not a concern if you're building a mobile gaming company. That's not a concern. It's not a concern. But if you want to build a online, let's say, marketplace where you need to figure it out for all the different geos on the ground, it could be very challenging. Like winning Germany means nothing about, you know, figuring it out in Spain. Whereas in the US, you know, sure, New York lives on their own planet, but most of the rest feels and looks, you know, the same. You don't need to make any major changes for your product or good market approach. So that's a structural issue in Europe. And as such, in some instances, it's better for a founder to come from a small country so that they would be building for a larger market from day one. They won't be tempted, you know, by their local market. I think before, Europe had a lot of issues with like the lack of funding, where the lack of quality of funding for startup founders to get started. Now I think there's ample funding for like angel, seed capital, Series A capital. Yes, there is some less capital available, you know, for growth stage opportunities here in Europe. But, you know, with the number of US firms, including ours, you know, opening offices in recent years in Europe, I think that gap, you know, has been bridged. It's a question of time. So we start seeing a lot more exits for that ecosystem to become a lot more vibrant. Then founders like yourself won't need to find themselves to migrate to the US. Like if you can delay that migration, if it's good for your business for as long as possible, clearly it's great news for Europe. Why do people migrate to the US if they're founders? To recruit executives, find more capital, be close to their customers, and be close to potential exit, you know, opportunities. So if more and more of these, you know, are in your neck of the woods in Europe, clearly it's going to be very beneficial for the local ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a trend, honestly.
But overall, you sound optimistic.
I am optimistic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I am.
I wanted to ask you about much smaller market, but because it's home, three things you think that need to happen in Greece so we see more founders and a better ecosystem?
Yeah, I think that's a better question to ask people who live and breathe, you know, all things Greece and Greek tech startups in all day long. Have observations, but I can't say, you know, what three things that need to happen because I'm not like on the ground, you know, every day. I think the trend here is also positive because there are 50 to 60, you know, like teams that get funding every year. The quality of the talent increases because more and more Greeks from overseas and others, of course, move back to Greece or move to Greece for the first time to start a business. We have now some successes of notable companies that have raised a bunch of money, like, you know, Ozale, Flexcar, Blue Ground. We've had some early awesome exits with companies like, get the name, the one from Dubai, InstaShop, of course.
InstaShop, yeah.
InstaShop, of course, you know, Viva Wallet. Like there have been enough, you know, early exits that got people believing that they can make, they can have a successful career. And also if you're an angel investor, make money, or if you're an investor in VC funds, make money. This needs to accelerate. And I do believe, you know, again, it's only a matter of time. The Greek startup ecosystem is small. You know, Greece is a small country. We only got started like, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. Like Viva, you know, was almost 20 years old when they had this amazing exit to JP Morgan. So with time, it will get better. So I don't have any specific, you know, asks of things that need, you know, to happen. I think the current government made it easier for people to figure out all things, you know, tax when they decide to move to Greece to join a company or start a company. Of course, there's more to do. Capital is not a concern at the pre-seed, seed, or early A stage. The European Investment Fund has provided ample funding, and now local, you know, sources, either government or individuals, are coming online, you know, to help. Overall, I'm optimistic for Greece. It's a small country, and it will take decades for this ecosystem to create a very meaningful footprint.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this is the business of exception. So if indeed, you know, one company gets started that grows to become massive very quickly, then all the folks who are in the universe of startups overseas are going to start be paying a ton more attention to Greece. That's what we need here.
Got it. And then the last question I wanted to ask is, what is the best way for a founder to get in front of you and get a meeting? And what's the worst way?
Oh, best way, they can contact me. They can email me. They can find me online and contact me.
What does a good email look like?
What is a good email? A very short email, like a few sentences and like why, you know, they think I'm interested in them. So like a very concise, you know, short email. A very bad way is to contact me and say, we have 300 years of experience. We're going to be building the first $10 trillion market cap company. The email comes from the head of investor relations who doesn't have a LinkedIn profile. And the executive summary is a document with 217 pages long. And I cannot view it on my mobile phone, but I need to download it when I'm in front of my laptop. It's a pretty bad way. Obviously, not all these things need to happen, but if one of these, you know, things happen, it's a bad way.
Awesome. Nico, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Kiriako, thank you. I appreciate you for your questions and for the attention. Thank you.